Good afternoon, and welcome to this panel on the many faces of reform. I'm Nancy Tate, the Executive Director of the League of Women Voters of the United States. The League is a nonpartisan organization that works to improve the U.S. system of government at all levels. We do this through our grassroots structure of nearly 900 state and local leagues in every state and in the District of Columbia. Many of you know us for our election work, our voter outreach, our voter education work, debates, and so forth. But in addition to that, we do a lot more. We take action on a lot of critical issues, and leagues work in their communities to inform members of the community about the critical issues confronting us. Certainly, the issues that we're going to be discussed today are critical. They're ones that the League is very concerned about and ones that we're active in working on. We're active in the areas of lobbying reform, redistricting reform, improving the election system in the United States, including but not limited to the Help America Vote Act, and of course we're very interested in the role the media plays in providing information to the public. The panelists that we have today are very distinguished and are going to be able to provide a lot of insight on these topics. Fortunately, because their backgrounds are so distinguished, they're all written down on the handouts that you've received, so I'm not going to read those to you. We're going to be hearing from the speakers in the order in the program and the order in which they're lined up here on the stage. We'll be starting with Norm Ornstein, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He'll be talking to us about institutional issues facing the Congress. Then redistricting reform from David Skaggs, who's a former congressman and currently the executive director of the Center for Citizenship and Democracy at the Council for Excellence in Government. Then the Help America Vote Act and other related election reforms from Bob Pastor, who's a vice president here at American University and executive director of the Carter Baker Commission on Reform Issues. And then, last but not least, we'll hear Andrew Schwartzman, president of the Media Access Project, talking about the media and its public service obligations. They are each going to speak for about 15 minutes, and then hopefully we'll have time to take questions and have a conversation. So with that, I'll turn it over to Norm.
I guess I'll start here. Thanks, Nancy, and I want to thank Kirk Gantz for putting together clearly a superb day. I'll start by answering the question, which is the subject of the day, the state of American democracy, and the answer is sorry. And it's nowhere more sorry in a sorry state than the Congress of the United States. Gripped with a failure to confront the most important issues of our time, as we saw with the embarrassing collapse of talks on the immigration bill last week, as well as the inability in the House of Representatives to come to any kind of an agreement on the budget, caught up with a whole series of scandals while waiting for the other shoes to drop, from the resignation and now imprisonment of Randy Duke Cunningham, to the forthcoming trial in Texas of Tom DeLay, who after resigning the position of majority leader in the House of Representatives has now announced resignation from his seat, to the indictments that have taken place, naming members of Congress as well as staffers and former staffers for corruption, all centered around the activities of lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Most recently, and just preceding Mr. DeLay's resignation, with the plea agreement of Tony Rudy, a former deputy chief of staff of his, Mr. DeLay's, who admitted to conducting a, quote, criminal enterprise, unquote, within the majority leader's office. This is not a very good time for Congress. Now, the theme that Kurt Gans suggested that I address reads, in light of recent scandals, what can be done to improve the ethical conduct of individual congressmen and enhance public accountability, and in light of the recent and intense partisan conduct of congressional leadership, what institutional changes are needed to ensure that Congress operates under fair procedures and in an informed manner. Let me start with the ethics issue, and let me start by saying I was having a conversation with a member of Congress this morning about the stories in a number of newspapers, but particularly in the New York Times last week, about Alan Mollahan from West Virginia, who is the ranking Democrat on the House Ethics Committee. And now it appears, while in the process of steering a large number of earmarks to nonprofits within his economically depressed district, also engaged in a whole series of business transactions with people who were the beneficiaries of some of those earmarks, and turned himself from a an individual of rather modest means to one with very substantial holdings. There is probably nothing illegal in what he did, and it doesn't appear, at least on the surface, as if that resembles the clear bribe-taking activities of Duke Cunningham, who, as you probably saw, put out an actual menu of how much money it would cost people to give him in return for the size of the contracts that he could get in return. But on the surface, it shows an astonishing level of insensitivity to propriety here. And I was thinking about it again as I drove up Massachusetts Avenue to AU for the conference. Just imagine if the word went out in the District of Columbia that for a variety of reasons, say because of budget cuts and related matters, that the police department was no longer going to enforce speeding laws in the district. There would be no radar, no cops waiting at corners, nobody to pull you over and give you a ticket. Now, a few individuals no doubt would take advantage of that and would go 120 miles an hour up and down Massachusetts Avenue, endangering themselves and everybody around them. But the general pattern of behavior would likely be that people would drive up Massachusetts Avenue and maybe go 45 in the 30-mile-an-hour zone and wouldn't bother to look at their speedometers to check whether they were in fact going that much over the speed limit, because it wouldn't matter very much anymore. And you get insensitivity to the nature of the law there for a purpose, for public safety, as a consequence. People I have seen speed up and then suddenly realize what they're doing on a stretch of road where occasionally there is a radar trap and slow down for that purpose because they know there's something happening there. Why did that make me think of Congress? Because the fact is we've had that equivalent in both the House and Senate over the last 10 years. We had something close to, no official announcement, but a clear sense that there was no police department. There has been no ethics process. And my guess is what Alan Mollahan did, which when you step back and look at it, especially for somebody who is a prominent figure on the Ethics Committee, is commonplace. Members go out and do aggressive things for their districts. There is no member, probably, who has more justification, given the nature of his district, to pursue federal earmarks for economic development than Alan Mollahan. West Virginia is in a terrible economic state. But in this environment, where earmarks have expanded dramatically for a set of other reasons that I will get to in a minute or two, but also where you're providing economic enrichment for individuals who are getting those earmarks, and you turn around and engage in business deals with them, it clearly has, at minimum, an enormous stink of impropriety about it, but my guess is it is commonplace for members to bring in earmarks and have friendships and relationships with people who may be engaged in those things, and then also have some business dealings with them, because they just don't think twice about it. People are not thinking about what's right and what's wrong, what's ethical and what's unethical, even if they are thinking about what's legal and what's illegal. Those are different sets of issues, and we have lost any of the safeguards that come around ethical behavior. It has reinforced a reality that I and my colleague Tom Mann, who is here and will be on the next panel, and we have just finished a book that will be out in late June called The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America, and how to get it back on track. This is an issue we have been grappling with for more than 20 years. The conclusion that we came to at that point, that it is simply not feasible for Congress to police itself entirely, as the Constitution says it should. And by the way, there's a misconception here. The Constitution doesn't say it must. If you look at the language that's there, they offer Congress the opportunity to do the full panoply of things that would allow them to police their own behavior, but do not take away the opportunity to delegate to others. And of course, if it comes to matters of illegality in the conduct of official business, that's left to prosecutors and the court, and we have seen members indicted and convicted of such things at times past. But if Congress does take on that responsibility, as the Constitution and the framers suggest it should, doing it the way it has traditionally been done, at least in our lifetimes, through internal House and Senate ethics panels, just doesn't work. It doesn't work because they place themselves in a position of damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you go after somebody aggressively, it's fairly easy to suggest that it's a political vendetta. If you don't go after somebody aggressively, it's a suggestion that the old boy network is at play. And for its own institutional integrity, as well as for the purposes of creating some set of boundaries around what's right and wrong, it is compelling to have some independent actor integrated into this process. My preference would be to move in the direction of a bill introduced by Senator Barack Obama, and that is to create a kind of commission patterned along the lines of commissions that have worked successfully in states like Kentucky and Florida, that would have in it significant participation by former members and former staffers, in part because other suggestions that you bring in, for example, retired judges or prosecutors, would not take into account a reality that the legislative process is different from other processes, that it's built into politics, that there's money exchanging hands, that there is log rolling going on. You want people who have a sensitivity to how the legislative process works. But it is not difficult to find people of impeccable integrity who know those things, but who are not internally constrained the way that existing members are. People, for example, like David Skaggs, much as he would hate to take on that burden, or Lee Hamilton, or John Porter. There are many out there who have those kinds of characteristics. But as we've seen, the resistance to any kind of outside involvement, to losing control in any fashion over their own fates, is enormous in both houses of Congress, to a point where when a watered-down option, an Office of Public Integrity, came up for a vote in the Senate, it was rejected by more than 2-1 margin. I think that is short-sighted and immature on the part of the Senate, a reflection of their own insularity and egos run rampant. And in the House of Representatives, they're moving even further away from any kind of reasonable re-energizing of an ethics process. At least in the Senate, there is an ethics committee where if you look and feel and listen closely enough, you will see a faint heartbeat. That isn't even the case in the House of Representatives. And I think, as John McCain said, when this particular proposal failed in the Senate, there'll be indictments coming and we will revisit this issue. They'll be back to it, but we're far from having some sense of boundaries around ethics. What is also the case is that these problems involving ethics have been reinforced by the way in which the legislative process has been conducted over the last decade plus as well. In a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times, Tom and I suggested a little bit of a variation of the broken windows thesis as it applies to crime in big cities. When you have a legislative process that basically has as its theme, anything goes, the ends justify the means, and when you have, as we have seen in the last decade plus, a breakdown in what we call the regular order, the rules and the norms that have governed the process disappear so that outcomes of a desired nature can be achieved. And that has come through extending votes that are supposed to be 15 minutes to 1 hour, 2 hours, or 3 hours, even after the point when we've seen a judgment. 218 votes in the House of Representatives against a particular bill. The vote stretched on until you can get an outcome. The chairman of the Rules Committee saying 3 hours. He didn't see a problem with having a vote go on for days if necessary, that it was perfectly within the rules. And it might be, but it is clearly not legitimate. And having conference committees that meet in the dead of night, that issue reports, including language that has not even been in the bills of either house that was considered beforehand, that shuts out members from a conference committee who've been elected by one house, that brings huge 1,000, 2,000, or 3,000 page bills to the floor for consideration without any notice or opportunity for people to read it and know what's in it. And at least one instance, a conference report that included a major piece of public policy that not only had not been considered in either house, but had not been considered in the conference. After they'd reached an agreement and shook hands, the leaders added it in after that, is not what anybody would consider the regular order. If that's the atmosphere, freewheeling and amoral, it's not surprising that you would find individual members decide to take advantage of that particular atmosphere, human beings finding their own failings, encouraged by that kind of process where things have gotten out of hand. Now, it is true that you can't legislate morality in many ways. If leaders in an institution want to break or bend their own rules, very likely, if they can get enough members to go along, they can get away with it, no matter what the rules say. And very likely, there will not be external checks and balances, particularly if most members are insulated from what is supposed to be the ultimate regulation, the voter's judgment. If you're in a district where you're not going to lose no matter what, you're not going to have any kind of a check or balance there either. But it is still the case, as we saw with some of the ways in which enforcement took place in New York City and other places when they were having problems with crime, when you set a different standard, and if you can alter the rules just enough, you can move back to at least some semblance of the regular order. We have a number of constructive proposals out there, some of them bipartisan, many of them, not surprisingly, coming from a minority party now. In the House of Representatives, the best package of proposals has been put together by four institutionalists, very thoughtful Democrats, David Obey of Wisconsin, Barney Frank of Massachusetts, David Price of North Carolina, and Tom Allen of Maine, with little chance of them being accepted now, but perhaps a little bit further down the road, that would deal with this issue of earmarks and bring some accountability to them, but would also deal with the integrity of the conference process and the integrity of votes on the floor. That's a start. It's not a conclusion. And frankly, there is no clear sign, despite the best intentions of members of the minority now, that if they moved into the majority, that those kinds of changes would be implemented. And then there would be a follow-through, where they would be adopted and enforced, even when circumstances would lead one to an embarrassing setback. The fact is that when Republicans took the majority in the House in 1994, after a series of abuses that didn't reach the level we've seen in the last few years, but that often were considerable and embarrassing, Newt Gingrich, then chairman of the Rules Committee, Jerry Solomon, and many other Republicans, as they took over, were absolutely honest in saying, we're going to operate in a different and fairer fashion. It didn't take long, however, basically only a few years, before that went by the boards, and in particular accelerated after George Bush got elected and we had Republicans running everything in Washington but with very narrow majorities. Those narrow majorities tend to alter behavior. If that behavior is not altered, however, the consequences are not just going to be in the niceties of looking at process and wishing it would operate better. Because the bottom line is this, and I will close with this, bad process makes for bad policy. We all suffer when there is a breakdown in the deliberative process and the regular order here. We see that in the poor quality of major legislative enactments like the Medicare prescription drug bill or the bankruptcy bill, which we go into in some detail in our book and show where thoroughly constructive amendments were rejected, not because they'd been considered on their merits, but because they didn't want to consider any amendments from a bill that had basically been drafted by an industry almost a decade ago. We see it as well in failures like immigration and in budget priorities, which have gone far more askew than we have had before. In the budget process, one simple reform enacted in 1990 that clearly worked for more than a decade, the pay-as-you-go provisions, it's the one major budget reform that actually brought some semblance of discipline, expired early in the Bush presidency, has not been reinstated. There is an aggressive move to keep it from being reinstated. And as a consequence of that, and basically a willful suspension of disbelief, we are seeing problems with budget deficits looking 3, 4, 5, 10 years down the road that are absolutely horrific. Bad process leads to bad policy, bad outcomes for all of us. Thanks.
Good afternoon. Glad to be with you. Following Norm Ornstein, which I've tried to do throughout my political career, I actually consulted with Norm in 1979 to get a reading list before I ran for Congress the first time, and he's been paying the price for his advice ever since.
We had 500 David Skaggs. I wouldn't be in this business.
I'm going to pick up, in a sense, where Norm left off. That is, drawing a linkage between process and product, but focused in particular on the way by which we draw congressional district boundaries, known in the trade as redistricting, to be distinguished from what precedes redistricting every 10 years, which is the reapportionment of the House of Representatives so that state congressional delegations correspond as nearly as possible to population in the country. Once the reapportionment is established, then each state, through the process that it has designed for itself, undertakes to create as many congressional districts as it has been apportioned, and by federal law and interpretation of the Constitution by the Supreme Court, each of those districts needs to be virtually equal in population. So why do we have a problem with redistricting? What is its implications for the quality of legislation, for the behavior of the Congress? Let me just sketch out the current situation. Out of 435 congressional seats around the country, by most assessments, we had maybe 30 or 35 congressional races last fall, the fall of 2004, excuse me, that were competitive. Not all of that non-competitiveness can be attributed to the consequences of redistricting manipulations, but because some incumbents, even in competitive districts, will do well and will render their districts essentially safe for themselves for a while. But many, many of those remaining 415 or so congressional districts were rendered safe by the redistricting process. And by safe, we mean a district in which one party's candidate or the other would typically be able to win easily by 55% of the vote or more. That would be, in current circumstances, probably an ideal we'd love to achieve, because so many of these races these days in 2004 were won by margins much, much greater than that. One of everyone's favorite adages who deals with this is that there was more turnover in the Soviet Politburo than we've had recently in the United States House of Representatives. What does it mean for us to have one of those safe districts? What are the consequences of that? And I want to look at this problem a little bit from the process side, that is what goes on in the electoral experience in one of those safe districts versus a competitive district or a more partisanly fair district, And what are the consequences of that once people coming out of that process get to Washington? From the electoral process side, if you're a candidate in either a safe Republican or Democratic seat, the real question about your political survival is decided in your party's primary nomination process, typically a process that is engaged in by, you know, 8 or 9 or 10% of the eligible electorate. And typically those are going to be your partisan stalwarts who are much more ideologically driven than the normal voter. And not surprisingly, if you're talking about one of these districts, will produce candidates that more often than not will come out of the same slice of their party's ideological spectrum, more conservative Republicans, more liberal Democrats. But people that, by virtue of that political experience of their own, are conditioned to really make their appeal to the people that have their future in their hands, that hardcore party group, one side or the other. That means that the general election in those kinds of districts is essentially a non-event, and not surprisingly, of little interest to voters. So there's a consequence here not just to the nominating process and who gets selected, but also the extent to which our whole political life seems vibrant, real, authentic, compelling to the American people. The obverse of that, more competitive districts produce a different kind of cat. If you are compelled in order to win an election to have to appeal to independents in your district, even to members of the other party, that affects greatly your behavior not just during the campaign but also once you're elected, because you are conditioned and you realize that your future success is probably going to have a lot to do with that continuing appeal beyond your party's hard core. Not surprisingly, when those sorts of members from either party get to the Capitol, they deal with their colleagues from the other party much the same way they deal with their voters from the other party. There is a much greater propensity to give and take, to working out the kinds of compromises that are the essence of productivity in the Congress and good governance. So the direct relationship between the process, how we design these districts, and the product, the kinds of people that get elected, and how they behave and do their jobs once they're here. What difference would it make if we designed these congressional districts with a priority not for safety for one party or the other, but to try to achieve better party balance and fairness and more competitiveness? And let me just stop and acknowledge that those things are in tension with each other. Competitiveness, if we were to elevate that beyond all other criteria, would mean for arguably a very volatile political environment, which small changes, small shifts in the voting behavior of a district or the country would produce dramatic shifts in the membership of the House. Party balance, party fairness, on the other hand, tries to acknowledge the fact that we are a divided people with different political affiliations, and that, again, with respect to a whole range of values, one of the values that we would like to see achieved in the way we design these districts is rough parity relative to percentages in the population between the parties. Some of us were just at a conference in Utah dealing with this, and just to pull that example out of the air, if one were to achieve party fairness in Utah, you would probably have one district there that was relatively safe for a Democrat, maybe one that was somewhat competitive, and the rest would be clearly inclined toward the Republican Party. If you were to try to achieve competitiveness, you would put that Democratic seat at great risk. You might have more competitive districts, but less partisan balance. So these are things that we are constantly going to be looking at striking the right balance and reform objectives. If we were able to get beyond, however, the current practice of designing districts to favor one party or the other, and elevated both of these goals of partisan fairness and competitiveness to the place where at least a lot of us believe they ought to be, we would end up, I think, with a Congress that was much more reflective of the population of the country, elections that were much more interesting to the country, and the behavior on the part of those that were elected that would start to get at fixing the broken branch, because we would be repopulating what has now been sort of the hollowed out center or moderate wing of both the Republican and Democratic parties. The people that are the ones that end up reaching across the aisle to try to solve these now seemingly intractable problems, some of which Norm was indicating in his remarks. Let me just sketch out some acknowledged limits on the extent to which redistricting reform for competitiveness and for party balance, the limits in what it can do. First of all, we are constrained by the Constitution and the one-person, one-vote rulings of the Supreme Court, so we're not talking about monkeying with that. And hopefully we will have a reauthorized and reinvigorated Voting Rights Act, which makes sure that the minority and traditionally underrepresented populations in this country have a fair shot at good representation. We can't change the extent to which the American people are self-segregating themselves by political persuasion and the correspondence that that has to some degree with other socioeconomic variables. So there are states simply where there are large areas where we can't find a competitive district without doing radical gerrymandering for that purpose, if at all. You can pick your favorite state, certainly parts of Arizona that there is no way we can have anything other than a solid Republican district, parts of New York State where you're not going to have anything other than a solid Democratic district. So we can't change that. And as I indicated a few minutes ago, we can't change the advantage that incumbents bring to the process. And as a former incumbent, that's not all bad. We don't want necessarily for there to be a wholesale change in the Congress every 2 years. What we do want is even good incumbents, who are doing a good job, to still have that sense in their heads that they need to perform well in the eyes not just of their party partisans but their broader electorate. So there are limits to what redistricting reform could accomplish, even if carried out as fully as we might hope. But how much is enough? Do we have to bring competitiveness and party fairness across the board to every corner of the country? I think the answer to that is no. I've done very informal polling of my own with my former colleagues, both those who have left office and those who are still in the Congress. And sort of a seat of the pants estimate is if you had 40 or 50 seats in both the Democratic caucus in the House and the Republican conference, that would inject an entirely different dynamic into the behavior of both the majority and minority parties, whichever they happen to be after next fall. So it's not as if we have to have 100% success rate in order to change the internal behavior and operations and sensibilities of the members, because if you had that 40 or 50 in both the Republican conference and the Democratic caucus, it would mean that all of the members of either party's organization in the House would have to be mindful that their ability to get anything done depended on that significant portion of their own colleagues in their own party that came from the kind of districts that required their members to be more moderate in their outlook and behavior and more collaborative in the way they operated in the Congress. What's going on to try to deal with this? Nancy Tate's organization, the League of Women Voters, has been active around the country for a long time on this issue. So has Common Cause and several other organizations. And many others of us, perhaps somewhat later coming to the issue, have recently been meeting in order to form what we hope will be an effective national coalition looking at state-level action, because these are changes that have to be taken under state constitutions and state statutes, but a larger coalition of reform-minded people from around the country, from minority communities, from both political parties that care about having a Congress and state legislatures, for that matter, that honor the real purposes of our democracy and want to create a political process that's more likely to serve the public interest. We are working with a view to trying to move some things along in some key states between now and the 2010 census and 2011 redistricting. It is a challenging, but I hope not a completely quixotic undertaking. And since we are here in a center of faith, I hope you will pray for us. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Curtis Gans, and thank you, Congressman Skaggs, for ending up by urging you all to pray. I thought it would be appropriate for a pastor to follow after Congressman Skaggs. And I'd like to officially welcome for the second time Curtis Gans Center for the Study of Electorate to here at American University, where other centers, including the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies and the Center for Democracy and Election Management, are all working to understand each dimension of America's and the world's democracy in an effort to try to improve all of them. Dan Quayle, former vice president, once said that democracy is inevitable and irreversible, but that could change. And there was an insight in that paradox, and it became very clear in the year 2000 when I myself had a wonderful opportunity to organize observation of elections in two countries, Mexico and the United States. And what occurred in that year, if you can remember that far back, was that the international observers judged that the election in Mexico was free and fair, but not really in the United States. And there were two lessons to be drawn from those two experiences. One is that a country that had manipulated its electoral process for more than a century and had one of the most fraudulent systems in the Americas, that is Mexico, in just 1988, in just 12 years, could make the transition to a very effective and professional electoral system. Whereas the second country, with over two centuries of democracy, one of the most advanced democracies in the world, could find its democracy in tatters because its citizens had become complacent. And that, of course, is the story of the United States. Since 2000, which was a wake-up call for all of America, people have become more engaged. And we have begun to focus on the electoral process. And we have begun to improve the administration of elections so that today we're almost half as good as Mexico. So we still have a ways to go. After the election of 2000, Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford both came together, formed a commission, and made a series of proposals, many of which became the Help America Vote Act of 2002. That Help America Vote Act, for the first time, the first piece of federal law aimed at election administration in our nation's history over two centuries. It channeled over $3 billion to the states to use to replace old voting machines, to be levers on behalf of altering our registration system so that it would be computer-based, interactive, and theoretically top-down, to permit people to vote provisionally if for some reason their name was not on a registration list, and to set a series of other requirements, together with the establishment of the Election Assistance Commission. These were supposed to modernize our system. But it was clear in the year 2004 it had not gone quite as far as it was supposed to go. And it's clear today, after all of the provisions of HAVA theoretically, should have been implemented by January 1st of 2006, that it still has a long way to go. Indeed, by the deadline, only half of the states had fully complied. One of the largest states, New York, has been under federal suit for complete failure to comply in almost any way. The Election Assistance Commission has not yet reviewed any of the registration lists, so that we don't know how good they are. We do know at least a quarter of the registration lists are not top-down, that is to say, the states are not in control. The counties and municipalities remain in control. This is the great myth of American federalism. It's not, the problem with American democracy is not that the states have control, it's that the states don't have control. Neither does the federal government. We have a system in the United States where there are 13,000 sovereign units. Each one decides the shape of the ballot, decides the machines that will be used, trains the poll workers or fails to train them, sets the rules on which our votes will count or not be counted. What the Help America Vote Act was supposed to do was to give leverage to the states to retrieve authority from the counties and municipalities, but it failed to do that. So, where do we go from here? And specifically with regard to the question on for this panel, which is, beyond HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, what procedural changes are needed to ensure both the integrity of the voting system and the enhancement of citizen participation? Well, after the election of 2004, Jimmy Carter once again became exercised at the inadequacy of our system, and he came together this time with James A. Baker III, former Secretary of State, and a leader of the Republican Party, and they together fashioned here at American University the Commission on Federal Election Reform, and the report is available out there, or if you don't have one, please come to see me. That report brought together 21 individuals, and many of the scholars that are here or at American University to advise the commission, and they proposed a truly modern system of election administration, one based on five pillars that could permit our system to be fully modern, and 87 very specific recommendations. What we found, of course, is what you've heard through the course of this day, and that is that America is very polarized. The partisanship has reached such a level that it's difficult for leaders of the two parties to even communicate with each other. Indeed, on election reform, the Democrats feel that the only issue is access to voting, and they want to remove whatever impediments, whatever restrictions exist that would allow anybody to vote anywhere for however many times they might like to vote. And the Republicans see the only issue as one of ballot integrity. They want to make sure that only the right people can vote only once. Well, as a person who has worked with Carter in more than 30 different countries observing elections, our answer was that there is no election that is any good that does not address concerns of both access and security. You have to have both. And so the fact that one party suggests that you only focus on access, and the other party suggests you only focus on ballot security, they're both right. And we structured in this commission's report a way to achieve both. It's not hard. In fact, most new democracies have figured this out, but we still haven't. We suggested that for ballot security, and for a simple reason, everybody should be prepared to identify themselves with a photo identification. Some people said this is too hard, the U.S. can't do it. But the truth is that Mexico, a far poorer country, distributed about 60 million state-of-the-art biometric identification cards, and everybody is proud of it and using it everywhere. Even in Haiti, they were able to distribute the identification cards. So from a technical standpoint, it should not be hard. And from a political standpoint, it should not be discriminatory. Indeed, it was the concern of the Commission that the proliferation of different identification systems could actually be a cause for greater discrimination in the hands of individual bureaucrats. And so therefore, a far better system is to make sure that everybody has a uniform card. And we recommended using the Real ID card, which will be a driver's license, in effect certified by the federal government, but issued by each state by the year 2008. That should be able to deal with roughly 87% of the citizens of America, many of which are not registered, and therefore, because the average registration percentage of the voting age population which is registered is roughly 75%, we should already be expanding the electorate with the Real ID card. And beyond that, the compromise, the recommendation of the Commission was for the state to play an affirmative role in reaching out and registering the rest of the population and giving those people who do not have a driver's license a free photo ID. Therefore, in the United States, we are one of the few countries in which the registration process is passive. The state waits for voters to come to them. We were recommending that we adopt a more affirmative role by the state to go out and register those populations that either don't have a driver's license or are disabled or are in assisted living. And therefore, every additional person registered represents an increase in the number of possible voters in America. By that recommendation, we were proposing that you could have both ballot security and increasing access for voting, increasing number of people voting. So that's what we propose with regard to that, but there is no reason why we can't have a universal registration system, that our population should be able to be registered once and with a simple card when they move to be deleted from the old precinct and added to the new precinct. And we need to do this because every year 40 million Americans move. And this becomes an additional impediment to voting in the United States. But even if that system works well, the only way that it can really work is if all Americans agree never to move from state to state. Unfortunately, 9 million Americans do that every year. And so therefore, we recommended making these registration lists interoperable. So that by a distributed database, we could ensure that each time a person moves from state to state, it would be deleted from one and added to the next state. That would permit a complete up-to-date registration list, and indeed handle what we believe are more than half of all of the problems that Americans encounter when they vote. In the year 2004, a number of civic organizations, including the League of Women Voters and Common Cause and others, set up a hotline for people to call in complaints. And we registered more than 250,000 such complaints, more than half of which were related to registration lists. So therefore, if you can have a completely up-to-date, interoperable, computer-based, interactive registration list, which is top-down and which the states are in control but distributed between states, then you can deal with more than half of all of the concerns people have. But that's not enough, because technology, which offers us promise, offers us also problems. Since 2000, the number of electronic voting machines in the United States have increased from roughly 12% to nearly 40%. And many Americans are worried about its implication. In the state of North Carolina, the position of agricultural commissioner was put into question because a large number of the votes were lost in a computer, an election computer, larger number than separated the two leading candidates. So therefore, people are saying we need some audit capacity for these electronic machines, and we recommended that should be a paper trail that could be built into the electronic machines and that could permit people to see, first of all, that their vote as inputted in the electronic machine was the same as what they intended it to be, and in a recount that there would be paper available for people to make sure that the computer result was the same as the paper result. And I think this is absolutely essential, and the technology is rushing to try to catch up to this great concern. One final set of recommendations which are critical in the judgment of the Commission to enhancing confidence in the electoral system, and that is the necessity of having our election administration to be nonpartisan and independent and professional. Again, most of the new democracies in the world have created, in effect, fourth branches of government that are charged with not only administering elections, but also in judging electoral disputes. We recommend that at the minimum, that our election administration be nonpartisan, that the Secretary of State, who is a partisan leader, should not be in charge of both running the campaign for a presidential candidate and administering the election. Many people say, well, it's too hard in the U.S. You can't get anybody who is nonpartisan. You can't establish a nonpartisan institution. That's nonsense, of course. Most countries have figured this out. We can figure it out. We propose a simple procedure by which you could get there, and that is that the executive nominate an election commission chairman, and that nomination needs to be approved by a supermajority of both houses of the state legislature, that is two-thirds. That would require the executive to put forward somebody who was viewed as above politics, somebody that both parties would find acceptable, somebody in which each party could veto if it were not acceptable and not nonpartisan. And the person designated for that position would begin to act in the way that they are required to act, which is above politics. In the same way that we hope that our Federal Reserve chairman is somebody who deals with monetary issues in a way above politics, the person dealing with our elections should be above politics. So, what have we found? We found after many, many years that General Electric takes more time, resources, and funding to make sure their voting machines are certified and accurate, that the state of Nevada takes more time, energy, and regulation to ensure that the slot machines are accurate and that are not manipulated, than any of the states in the United States take to make sure that our voting machines are certified and accurate. We, in short, have a long way to go. The faces of reform, which is the subject of this panel, is faceless right now. There is no reforms underway in the U.S. Congress. There is a lot of work being done in the states, but it's not at all clear that this isn't necessarily in a positive rather than a partisan direction. And what about the state of democracy? I think we are in danger of being stateless as well. So it's time for election reform, and there's only one way to achieve it, and that is that the American people have to be fully engaged, because those who run for office are satisfied with the process, because it's proven to them that it's obviously good. And so we cannot expect them to make the changes to modernize the election system to reform it so that at least someday will be as good as Mexico's, unless the people of the United States demand it, through organizations like the League of Women Voters and Common Cause, and through active personal engagement. Thank you.
Andy Schwartzman.
Good show.
Let me preface my remarks with a rather presumptuous clarification on behalf of the panelists who've already spoken, as well as myself, and I'm taking it upon myself to speak for all of us. I've been doing this more or less on and off for 35 years. I've been at Media Access Project for 28 years. You couldn't do it if you weren't an optimist. I'm about to describe some problems, and you've heard some problems, but not one person sitting at this table, I say presumptuously, disbelieves in the quality of the American system or the quality of American democracy. We all want to make it better. So let me start by saying that we've had the best system of electronic media and broadcasting in the world. It's deteriorating. But we've gotten to where we are because of, not in spite of, a regulatory system that until recently called upon broadcasters to do some public service in exchange for their free access to publicly owned spectrum. The FCC has in recent years allowed constant and continuing deterioration in the quality of service that we receive from over-the-air broadcasting. We're approaching a very important moment because Congress has finally set a date for the transition from analog to digital television broadcasting. And that's something I have to express great appreciation to Norm Ornstein for his hard work in trying to pave the way for ensuring that this transition has had a benefit for the American public. And I'm sad to report that for almost 6 years, the FCC has had pending before it a proceeding in which it has been asked to set standards for over-the-air broadcasting in the digital age and to take into account the incredible gift of access to a chunk of spectrum as big as the chunk that they've had before, free of charge, without any competition, and expect broadcasters to provide some elements of service to the community, including improved coverage of local issues and elections in particular. So far, the FCC has done nothing, and the current FCC chairman doesn't seem to consider this to be a major priority item. We have roughly 3 years until this deadline, and it is a very short time within which for broadcasters to act and prepare. And if we wait much longer, the broadcasters will say, well, we couldn't prepare. We know what broadcast media are capable of doing in terms of informing the public. We also know that they tend not to do it or tend not to do their best unless we make them. This problem has been exacerbated by rules since the 1996 Communications Act that have allowed increased concentration of ownership of these broadcasting property in fewer hands. I won't elaborate on that, but it is an exacerbating factor. This morning, Ken Goldstein alluded to shortcomings in coverage of local elections. And I want to follow up on that and elaborate a little bit. First, the audience here today, the people following this event on C-SPAN, we are a very special group. We are a subset of the American public. It is true that for those of us who are C-SPAN junkies, those of us who read 3, 4, 5 newspapers a day, those of us who subscribe to political publications and scour the internet have access to an incredible wealth of journalism, news, and information, as well as spirited debate on the internet from individuals and blogs. But that's not what the bulk of the American public relies on to get news and information, to make the most fundamental decisions you can make in a democratic system, particularly at the local level. Over-the-air television and daily newspapers, and to some degree increasingly the internet counterpart, that is the sites operated by local daily newspapers, are the principal sources for news and opinion at the local level. Cable is not a meaningful contributor. All the news channels, which incidentally have a very surprisingly low overall viewership, I don't want to get into numbers, but again, this is a very small subset of the population. Cable doesn't contribute meaningfully to debate on local issues. You can't decide for whom to vote for city council from cable. In the largest cities in this country, there is one cable news channel that adds anything to local coverage, and these channels are almost without exception owned by an existing newspaper or television station and carry recycled material from that medium. That is, they don't really contribute something new. Rather, they're an alternate means of distribution, or as we say these days, repurposing the same content. Every year, the Cable Advertising Bureau puts out a press release which says something like, this is the year that cable advertising is going to become a major factor in electoral politics. And yes, over 25 years, cable advertising has become somewhat more important. But if you have the money, you have the capability, you spend those incremental dollars on over-the-air broadcasting, because that's what the American public watches, that's what the American public uses to make up its mind. Now, at the local level, this is especially important. Radio has ceased to be a factor. There are, in most communities, one or two stations with any meaningful news staff and news presence. In addition, there is often a single public radio station that contributes to that mix. Under the FCC's guidance, the bulk of radio broadcasters have stopped carrying their own news, and if they carry any local news at all, it's a syndicated product which is carried on many, many stations. Many of the announcers you hear broadcasting the same news from a single newsroom using different names all work for one company that in a market like Washington, D.C., programs news to 20 or 30 stations. Again, I suppose it's better than nothing, but it doesn't contribute to the diversity of viewpoints and perspectives. It doesn't give people a comparative basis on which to make up their minds for whom to vote. The internet is increasingly important, but again, nationally, locally, sure, there are local listservs and news groups and viral campaigns, and we're all learning how to use the internet, and I have great hopes for the internet. But the blogs that have made such a major contribution in the cutting edge of debate and national politics in the last couple years are national in scope and focus. and aggregating the clicks to try to develop that on a local level has yet to happen. So we're left to rely on local broadcasting, not local cable, not local radio, local television, in order to get some perspective on how bad things have gotten. Working with the Campaign Legal Center in Chicago and Milwaukee, we monitored 1 month prior to the November general election all of the newscasts, bearing in mind that this is television, bearing in mind that a large number of the television stations have no newscasts at all, indeed no public affairs programming, no contribution to the discussion of issues and ideas at the local level. This, even though broadcasters theoretically are licensed to serve particular communities and pledge to provide information of importance to those communities. We found overall, and I'll use Chicago numbers here, bearing in mind that this was something of an off year in Chicago, but that local politics is blood sport in Chicago. 7.8% of the total time within newscasts was devoted to elections in that four-week period. U.S. presidential and U.S. Senate races, and this was the Obama race, which was not a close one, was 79% of that. That is 79% of the 7.8%. All other Illinois contests accounted for approximately 8% of the election coverage. In other words, less than 1% of the total time devoted to newscasts in 1 month prior to the election in Chicago was devoted to coverage of local elections. Now, within that, about a third of it was discussion of campaign strategy, and about 20% of it was horse race coverage, who's ahead, the latest poll. Just about 15% of this minuscule amount of coverage actually involved the candidates themselves discussing issues, and the average candidate soundbite was 10.2 seconds long. Now, we expect this license renewal challenge brought against all of the television stations in the Chicago and Milwaukee markets to fail. We expect the FCC to renew the licenses. And that will be a measure of what the FCC condones and accepts as service in the public interest. We want more attention paid to these local elections. This is a leap of faith as well, but we can't regulate quality. But we want quantity, because unless you have quantity, you can't even argue about the quality. The digital television transition is a critical moment, last great chance we will have probably for a generation to affect electronic coverage of news. Yes, it's true that technology is changing. Yes, it's true that new delivery mechanisms are coming in place. That is all well and good for 10, 12, 20 years from now, pick your number. But we have to get from here to there. And we're not going to get from here to there optimally, democratically, unless we get the FCC to do something about it. Thank you.
Well, we've had an excellent panel, and they brought up a lot of interesting points, and we have a little bit of time now. And I'm wondering if there's anyone in the audience who'd like to ask a question. I think we have someone with a microphone who will come up to you. So there's, I see one person back there. Please specify which person you were addressing the question to.
Well, I guess specifically Robert Pastor, but anyone who would want to give this a try. Do concerned committed individuals who no longer have power make any difference in reform? Are individuals like Jimmy Carter or James Baker having as much influence in the United States as they are in other nations, for example?
That's a good question. I think they came together because they were concerned about both the state of the election system in America and also about the state of the political parties and the partisanship and the polarization, and therefore tried to fashion something that would reflect legitimate concerns by individuals in both parties and would represent a step forward for the United States as a whole. But it was clear almost from the beginning that the U.S. Congress was not interested in the reforms or interested in moving beyond the stated positions of each of the parties. I think we have found, however, over time, that what seems impossible in the short term can become very possible in the medium term. We have Jack Abramoff, who is one of the least likely figures to have been a promoter of lobbying reform, to have become the major catalyst behind it, even though lobbying reform has not gotten as far as many of us would like. Indeed, he's pushed it a step forward. I think the reforms which the two of them have proposed will be back on the table at the national level at some point in time, given what we know about how American politics works. It's likely to only occur when there is a new crisis or a new scandal, as I believe we may very well see in 2006 during the elections, for two reasons. One is we have introduced a lot of changes, both in machines and in rules, and these are not widely understood, but the public is watching much more closely. So if there is a close or disputed election in 2006, I think the American people will become very energized very quickly. And that indeed could lead to a more serious consideration of these reforms. So while your premise is correct, these are individuals to a great extent who now exert more influence abroad than they do at home. I think they have laid out a blueprint that in the right circumstances will be seriously considered by our election system, by our national legislators, and already is being considered at the state level.
Do we have another question? We have over here.
You know, I'm very heartened by the quality of these ideas for reform, but I have a fundamental sort of distrust of our capacity or the capacity of congressmen especially to bring about meaningful reform. And several of you have mentioned the importance of getting the public involved and finding ways of creating a groundswell of pressure, because if we don't, again, bad policy is a declining country. Bad process, bad policy, bad policy, a declining democracy. So this is my huge audacious idea. And I just want to throw this out for your consideration. The question is, how do we get the American public to focus on the way these processes are causing damage to our democracy? And so what I'm wondering is, what if we had our greatest Americans reassemble in Philadelphia, driven by the values of Hamilton and Madison and the Federalist Papers, to rethink a variety of these processes that are involved in politics, lobbying, elections administration, congressional rules and norms, and have our greatest citizens from many different sectors of our society, lawyers, journalists, our greatest scientists, to be guided by people like yourselves. They might take a month or two, the public might follow it, and have a great summit about our democracy and what we might do to position ourselves from a process point of view to be more effective in the next decade or so. So that's right. My
well,
audacious idea.
Okay. Who wants to jump in on this? Andy does.
Respectfully disagree with your proposition. I think we have plenty of top-down guidance from experts. Speaking as a middle-aged, white-haired male, I think there's plenty of middle-aged, white-haired males giving recommendations. What we need is much more attention to energizing the electorate from the bottom up, and there is evidence that the right issues presented the right way can energize the public. Downtown, this very day as we speak, there are hundreds of thousands of people marching in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere around the country for an issue. In my own area, we generated, and this is a very big we, not my organization by itself, depending on whose count you have, between 1.5 and 2 million people contacting the FCC to express their concern about ownership of the mass media. This was not some sort of manufactured AstroTurf, manufactured grassroots experts campaign. This was people in the American public realizing, even if they didn't understand all the details, that owning too many media properties was not a good thing. I think that the challenge to try to energize the public on issues like this is not to try to get a group of experts to convince the public they ought to care. It's trying to manufacture messaging and implementation of these issues in a way that will get a bottoms-up reaction.
David, I think you wanted to comment.
Thank you. I want to fertilize the grassroots also, I hope with organics rather than chemicals. And by that I mean that we need to recognize that this business of democracy and government is complicated stuff. We aren't hardwired naturally to understand and know how to do it. We learn how to do it in our schools, and education in American schools about government, about history, about politics, about geography has atrophied dramatically in the last generation. We can't realistically expect a people that hasn't been sufficiently schooled in the mechanics and the operation and the history of its own system of self-government to participate in it fully and knowledgeably and enthusiastically. There are lots of other pieces to the puzzle, but in a sense, I align myself with Andy's comments. I think we need to figure out more about that fundamental ingredient in a healthy democracy, and a lot else will flow from that if we can get back to doing that right.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'd like to send my colleagues to Philadelphia, frankly. to stay for at least a month in the summer without air conditioning and see if they can come up with a new constitution. I think that'd be great for them. Don't you think? Would you guys like to do that?
Sure, yeah.
Is there... Or,
get a microphone.
Behind right you. Behind. My notion here was not that it would be a top-down prescription, but that it would create... It would get the public to focus on this and become aware of it. and then there would be a grassroots movement behind that. Maybe a large collection of organizations, such as the ones you've mentioned here, who would create a grassroots movement throughout the country to bring about some of the implementation of these recommendations. That's where I was coming from.
Maybe if we could televise it and have it called Deal or No Deal, we would get a public engagement.
Reality democracy. I think there was someone else right here. Yes.
Thank you. A lot of you guys have touched on various election issues, and particularly I liked some of the things that were said about the importance of local politics. Recently, there's been some attention to this national popular vote proposal that came out with support from the center, which is basically an attempt to circumvent the electoral states assign their electors to whoever wins the majority, the plurality of the national popular vote. But that proposal seems to me to draw some concerns, particularly with regard to the issue of, when you expand the voter pool, you actually decrease incentive for voter participation. And so it seems to me like that might actually have some negative effects, but I'm interested to hear what some of you have to say, particularly potentially about the district-based assignment of electoral college votes as an alternative proposal that also doesn't require constitutional amendment. Okay. Is it clear what I'm asking?
Who wants to jump in on that?
Yeah. It's an interesting idea that's been floated out there, basically as a way of avoiding a constitutional convention, to in effect have what would be a small number of states, the biggest ones, basically because states can do with their electors as they wish, instruct their electors to vote on the basis of who won the popular vote in the state. The popular vote nationally, ignoring what happened in the state. It's a disturbing proposal, I find, in a whole host of ways. Not only would a small number of states basically be able to unilaterally circumvent the rest of them, but you'd have a whole series of questions. Since there really are issues raised about faithless electors and what actual sanction can be applied when somebody goes and votes how he or she wishes, whether you would find in a state where 48% of the vote of the electors might be on the wrong side of what happened nationally but want to go the other way, and the state goes that way, voting however they wished when they got to the Electoral College anyhow. So you've got that issue. You've got the larger question of whether we ought to move to a direct popular vote. And then what you suggested as an alternative to avoid a situation where a lot of voters in states that didn't have this proposal, knowing that they votes didn't mean anything, whether they would turn out basically. Maybe you could energize more voters if you had electoral votes cast by congressional district. A lot of people in a state like California who come from Republican areas who now basically know that their votes in a presidential election at least aren't going to matter because it's basically all going to go one way might feel a little bit differently. And it's worth considering. But I think in a larger sense, people who want a direct popular vote and who are passionate about it look at all the problems that ensue from having the national nightmare that can occur and that did in 2000, nightmare used in quotation marks, of an electorate nationally going in one direction and an electoral college going in the other. Interestingly, you got no peep out of the public about that. Public basically, instead of reacting violently, as many people assume they would, basically said, those are the rules, and you play by the rules. Those who want a direct popular vote never look at the nightmares that could occur if we had a direct popular vote. Just to take it back to 1960 as one good example, where the national popular vote was divided by less than 0.1% nationwide. Consider what happened in Florida, confined to one state, and imagine every ballot box in the country impounded.
not an army of lawyers going to one state, but 50 armies fanning out everywhere, not lasting 1 month, but lasting numerous months before you'd have a winner. And then any winner under those circumstances losing an enormous share of legitimacy. So I think we need to have a much greater sense of perspective about reforming this process before we move willy-nilly in any direction.
Bob?
I've been a close friend of Norm Ornstein for about 30 years and on many panels, and finally, after all of this time, we found something in which we can disagree with. I think the Electoral College was a brilliant progressive innovation in the 18th century, but is tragically obsolete for the 21st century. We have purported to go all over the world and indeed shape the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the United Nations so as to ensure that a fundamental principle, the right of each citizen to choose their leaders directly, should be now enshrined everywhere in all but six countries in the world and the United States. I think the Electoral College is obsolete and it needs to be changed so that people can vote directly for their leaders. There are large, poor countries like Indonesia, India, that do have national votes and that do vote for their leaders, and each person's vote counts. We all know every vote does not count in the United States for the president because of the way the Electoral College is structured. If you're in a safe state, the leaders themselves know not to campaign there, but rather to campaign in only the battleground states and not to campaign nationally. So I think we need to change the system. The problem, as we all know, is that the requirement to change the Constitution is sufficiently difficult, and that small states interpret their interest as reflected in the current arrangement, that it will be very difficult to get to the point in time where that needs to be changed. It's a little like the right to vote in the District of Columbia. There are very few democracies in the world in which you cannot vote for a national legislature in the nation's capital. I think these are two very flawed elements in our system that need to be corrected. Now, having said that, I don't fully agree with the proposal for the national popular vote as it's currently developed. I think it's a clever way to try to obviate this problem, but I think that there are problems with the way it does it. In particular, states can opt for the system and then opt out of the system, leaving the rules very uncertain for the country and for the people who vote. So I think it's extremely unrealistic from a political standpoint at this moment in time to advocate a change in the Electoral College or to advocate the rights of people who live in the District of Columbia to vote for the legislature. I think that's the best approach, and we need to, as a people, come behind that just because of the sheer integrity and decency of those proposals.
Well, I think that will be the end of our session today. I hope you will join me in thanking this panel. And we thank AU and Curtis Gans for hosting us.